From KQED Public Radio, this is Capital Notes, our weekly look at California politics. I'm John Myers from KQED, and Anthony York, my good friend, the editor of Capital Weekly, is on spring break in Southern California.
Well, we prefer the phrase on assignment.
Come on now, it's spring break week, York.
Hey, let the record show that I worked a little bit this week. A little bit.
And so this isn't one of those spring breaks like that involves beer bongs or staying up all night or, you know, some kind of partying?
Hey, what happens in the undisclosed location stays in the undisclosed location.
Fair enough, fair enough.
Need to know basis, Myers.
So he's still watching California politics from his perch down south, and I'm watching it from my, perch up here?
Your hole there?
Yes.
Podcast Central?
Podcast Central at the state capitol. So let's talk about what's been going on this week in the political world. Probably first thing we could talk about is campaign dollars. We're going to get some campaign finance data. We're taping this on Thursday, so by the end of the day, we're supposed to get kind of the first, I mean, would you call it this? I kind of usually do. It's the first real full picture of where committees have raised money and spent money for the special election.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think a lot of us have been monitoring the day-to-day, daily filings on some of this stuff, but you're right. I mean, today will be when we get a more comprehensive snapshot.
Or a larger snapshot, or maybe more than a snapshot, a portrait.
Okay, a portrait, an evolving portrait, like Jerry Brown's gubernatorial portrait.
that somewhat impressionistic painting residing in the state capitol. All right, so the governor told reporters on Thursday in an event about federal stimulus money, which we'll talk about in a moment, but told reporters in Sacramento here on Thursday that his campaign that he's part of, the Budget Burrito campaign, do you think that's ever going to stick?
I don't know. It seems to have stuck within the confines of this podcast, if nothing else.
Because I continue to trump it up.
You're a tenacious burrito purveyor.
The campaign to pass all the measures, all six budget-related measures. That campaign he's involved with, he told reporters that campaign had raised $9 million so far and said that the campaign needed to raise $15 million. Now, I don't know. I guess it's going to depend on what expert you speak to, whether or not that means they're on track, behind track. I mean, again, we don't have a tremendous amount of time left, but governor's a pretty good fundraiser, so.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's just dollars. You know, I mean, I think there are a lot of questions about how you run a campaign like this. I mean, if you do the traditional barrage of commercials. We saw the campaign launch some radio ads, which I'm sure we'll talk about shortly, earlier this week. And, but I think this could be much more of a mail-heavy campaign than a big television ad blitz. But I guess we'll see in the next 6 weeks. Is that what we've got here? I'm losing track.
Something like that. We'll get our
calendar. Yeah.
Yeah, you're a little fuzzy when you're on spring break, so I'll get you to come back on that.
It's all the beer bongs, the aforementioned.
Just like I said.
A trap.
Well, you're right in that you could definitely run a different kind of campaign, and that's what a lot of political consultants have told me, and I'm sure have told you, and have told a lot of people. And mail is one of them, but radio is cheap. I mean, by comparison to television, radio is cheap. You can cut the spots pretty quickly. You can move them around if you need something. We don't know how much radio they bought this week. That's one of the problems when they roll out ads. They don't really show you whether it was an ad mainly rolled out for the press and they get what's called free media, or whether they actually put money behind it. But since you reference these radio ads, why don't we take a little sample here? So the first one is the radio ad that the burrito committee, I've got to not call them that, the yes on 1A, B, C, D, E, and F committee put out. So let's take a listen to that one.
Education shows that more teachers are facing pink slips due to state.
As California unemployment reaches 10%.
Officials warn senior health care could be cut as a result of the growing.
We're hearing more about the impact of California's budget crisis. It isn't pretty. We can bring sanity and stability to our budget process and take away the politician's blank check in a special election on May 19th. Yes on measures 1A through 1F will help protect against even higher taxes and prevent more cuts to schools, public safety, healthcare, and infrastructure. 1A through 1F gives us short-term revenue and long-term budget stability. Visit cabudgetreformnow.com. See why teachers, taxpayers, business, labor, seniors, firefighters, and police all support 1A through 1F.
Paid for by Budget Reform Now, a coalition of taxpayers, business, labor, educators, public safety, seniors, Jerry Parencio, and Governor Schwarzenegger's California Dream Team, a ballot measure committee. Yes on 1A through 1F.
You've got to love that tagline, do you not?
I know.
Now that's now people obviously if you don't follow this, that's a legally required tagline where you have to say who the largest donors are. But I mean, I think the tagline almost takes up more time than part of the message.
It does, but it is inclusive, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, you've got all the biggies, you know, labor, teachers, firefighters, Parencio. They're all there.
Everybody's there.
Now, what else could you find?
Let's talk about the ad just for a moment. I mean, you can tell me your thoughts. I mean, one of the things that I, you know, in listening to the ad and kind of what their pitch is, where they are talking about that the measures will help prevent higher taxes and more cuts. Well, the reality is, and that, I'm not saying that that's completely wrong, but also the Ledge analyst has also said we have an extra $8 billion deficit that we didn't have when those measures were enacted. So it remains to be seen whether these measures are really the sole solution. I don't think a lot of people think they are.
Well, no, and really we've talked about this before. Prop C, D, and E would fill about $6 billion worth of budget hole. That $8 billion figure that was projected by the LAO, I believe, is based on the assumption that all the ballot measures pass.
Yeah, it correct? Is. It is.
So, you know, you can make the argument this is sort of splitting hairs, but at least the $6 billion worth of budget solutions that are on the ballot could prevent. I mean, look, if that $6 billion doesn't come through in the form of this borrowing or taking in Prop C, D, and E, borrowing from the lottery, taking from mental health and childhood development fund, then they're going to have to make that up somewhere, and the only two ways you can make it up are through more revenues or less spending.
Well, of course, borrowing in the years past we did, but then of course 1A is attached to about $16 billion worth of tax increases that aren't necessarily in the year to come, but are part of trying to stabilize a budget process in the next couple of years. So,
right, and then 1B would be $8 billion additional spending on schools. Which...
Well, let's talk about 1B. That was a good transition, Anthony.
Segue.
Yeah, you are even in your spring break induced leisure
fog.
Moments.
Fog.
Fog.
Yeah.
Even in that, you were able to do the transition. So here's the radio ad that the California Teachers Association put out. They're calling it Yes on 1A and 1B, but it's really 1B. Here it is.
All right, finally they're getting it. Props 1A and 1B are on the May 19th special election
ballot. Wait a minute. There's another special election coming up on May 19th?
Yeah, there is. Prop 1A is going to help our state budget, and if we adopt Prop 1A, then Prop 1B will begin paying back some of the gigantic cuts that have hurt our schools, when the economy improves, of course.
Okay, I need to take this election more seriously. So a yes vote on 1B will help repay some of the recent cuts to education,
right,
and get our schools up-to-date textbooks, smaller classes, and rehire some of the teachers that have been laid off?
Yeah, that's right. And Prop 1A helps stabilize state spending and creates a long-term reserve fund to protect against more cuts to schools and children's health care, police and firefighters in the future, too.
So Prop 1B is about helping repay our schools, and Prop 1A will help stabilize our state budget?
Right.
I can vote yes for that.
Paid for by Yes on 1A and 1B. Repay and protect our schools. Sponsored and major funding by California Teachers Association Issues PAC.
Do you have any idea what that background noise is in that commercial?
It sounds like a data center.
It's kind of, I mean, I kept thinking, where are these two people? Grocery
store?
They're
in a cubicle, right? It's cubicle noise. It's white noise.
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm sure somebody from the campaign will probably want to tell me afterwards.
There's ominous clicking and electronic ringing of phones muted in the background. I don't know.
Got it.
Maybe they're on the copy desk there at the San Francisco Chronicle. I have no idea.
All right. Well, suffice it to say, that is an ad that really is all about 1B, is it not? I mean, it's almost as though they kind of begrudgingly have to mention 1A. Now, maybe I'm reading that into it, but 1A is quickly mentioned, but it's all about the schools and 1B.
Well, and that is, I mean, it's because this is the ad paid for by the teachers. 1B is the education measure, you know, that does, as the ad stated, pay back about $8 billion to schools. And, of course, there's linkage in that 1B will only be enacted if 1A passes. So perhaps that is begrudging, or know to be our own sense of the CTA, of the Teachers Association's view about 1A. I don't get the sense that they're very enthusiastic about it, but they're going along with it because they cut their deal and got Prop 1B out of the deal.
Well, suffice it to say that the description of 1A is very brief. It says something like, oh, and it'll help stabilize the budget. But back to schools, back to 1B.
Right.
I mean, it's you know, that's very much the way that the ad is set up to really hammer home the schools, which, I mean, that's what they're really concerned, the $9 billion. But, of course, 1A's got to pass at the same time. So,
anyway. Well, and to their credit, look, the Teachers Association has run measures both focused on education and they ran something what they called the Budget Accountability Act back in 2004, I believe it was, which was focused on lowering a vote threshold to raise taxes. That messaging didn't work so well. So I think part of this might reflect the belief that that the teachers have that the strongest messaging is still education, still schools, because that's still an issue that Californians care deeply about.
Meantime, a couple of rumblings on three of the other ballot measures, 1D and 1E. 1D is the transfer of tobacco tax money that now goes to childhood development programs to the budget problem. And 1E is a temporary transfer of millionaire tax proceeds that now go to mental health services to the budget problem. The 1D and 1E forces, I'm thinking of the old Wonder Twins. You remember the cartoon,
Jan
Wonder
and Jana.
Twins? Exactly.
Jan and Jana, yes.
They bonded.
An ice cube.
Formed of a powerful no committee together, maybe, right? That's what they did.
Yeah, right. You know, certainly they have joined. We'll give them that. The reality is they don't have a lot of money to spend on a no campaign. You talked about earned media before, free media. I think that's going to be the focus of the no on 1D and 1E campaigns. And I think that we're all still waiting to see if there's going to be any big money that comes in primarily against 1A. Going back to the burrito approach works for not only for the yes side, but perhaps also for the no side too. And I think that it's very likely that if some money does come in against these measures, that we could see all of them, at least A through E, go down.
Well, I neglected to mention that part of the no on 1A campaign did make itself known in my little old mailbox this week. I got a mailer from People's Advocate, the group run by Ted Costa, who is the man who wrote the 2003 recall against Gray Davis, a mailer against Daryl Steinberg, the president pro tem of the state Senate, saying, he raised your taxes in this horrible budget, da-da-da-da-da, he's a bad guy, he, you know, whatever. But it was the first sign of an attack, and I don't know whether some of that's going to get specific to different markets, different districts, that different lawmakers represent, but I got that mailer just the other day, so who knows?
I didn't get that mailer. We'll have to go off air. Off air, we'll compare party registration notes and see who they're targeting.
Hey, full disclosure here, York, I'm declined to state.
As am I, so maybe I don't know. Maybe I don't live in the right zip code.
We'll find that out. But that mailer came on Tuesday or Wednesday, so there is some activity, but you're right. You really need a larger shoe, right, to drop.
An SEI shoe.
A Meg Whitman shoe, a Steve Poizner shoe.
Yes.
Someone.
Yeah, and that shoe, as of now, has not yet revealed itself.
Before we leave the budget completely, really quickly, we should make note of the fact that the recall effort against one of the Republicans who voted for the budget moved forward this week, Anthony Adams, the state assemblyman from San Bernardino County, was officially served with his recall notice. I think it was at the same event where the governor was raising money for him on Wednesday.
And was served by Mike Schroeder, a former chairman of the California Republican Party.
And didn't he have some great line? I saw it in your roundup.
Right. It was something along the lines of, on behalf of the taxpayers of the 59th Assembly District, let the games begin, or something. I'm botching the quote here, but I'm sure he rehearsed it in front of the mirror many, many times.
I was kind of hoping maybe he had like a boombox with him with the Monday Night Football theme.
Dun, 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 dun.
Exactly. Dun, 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 dun. Anyway, So that, I mean,
I'm sure, you know, give Mike a call. He might be able to hook that up for you.
Just briefly, I mean, your thought on that. I mean, a recall is not terribly easy to move forward, but these are very strange magnified times, especially when you've got talk radio hosts and things. I mean, that'll be worth watching, I would say. Would it not?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there is, to tie these two things together, the recall of Anthony Adams and the special election on May 19th, you know, the one thing in both things that you just don't, in both campaigns, the great unknown is the turnout model. Who's going to vote? And perhaps it's only the most dedicated people who turn out to vote. And if that's the case, there could be a danger for Anthony Adams. Now, you know, keep in mind, it's not just Republicans who live in his district. I don't think there's any support among Democrats to recall Anthony Adams. And so, but, you know, will they come to the polls to vote? I don't know when that recall election will be. Presumably it would be, not in May, it'll be in June or sometime when that would be the only thing on the ballot.
Well, that is that also depends on how fast they gather signatures.
Right, right. Because Adams was served with notice as part of the process. They can now go out and gather the signatures and try to qualify the recall measure for the ballot. But you know, I mean, I think that talking to Adams's political advisors, they're taking the threat very real. And even if there is no recall campaign, Adams is going to face perhaps a tough re-election campaign next year. So I think Anthony Adams, one way or another, is in full campaign mode and taking all of the threats against him very seriously.
All right, well, let's talk about a different kind of money in politics that you guys at Capital Weekly reported on this week, the world of behested payments, of not necessarily, not technically political money, but very much political money, it seems. I mean, talk a little bit about the process and then what you guys found.
Yeah, these are payments that are made to nonprofits and often to charitable organizations, although not always, at the request of politicians. So these are donations made by many of the same interest groups who participate in regular campaign contributions, and politicians have the ability to guide money to a nonprofit group or a political group or a charity of their choice. So, you know, overall, there were about since January 2008, there have been about $41 million of these payments made. Now, these are not payments that show up on a regular campaign finance search on the Secretary of State's website, although the Fair Political Practices Commission has begun tracking these payments, and Roman Porter, the executive director over there, and Ross Johnson, the FPPC chairman, have done, I think, a really good job of beginning to track these payments and make them available to the public. And, you know, a lot of these things go to organizations that do end up benefiting some of the politicians directly. I mean, Jerry Brown, the attorney general, has a couple of charter schools in Oakland that he began that are sort of pet causes that he believes in very strongly, but he goes out and raises money for. This money is not subject to any sort of campaign contribution limit. I believe if it does go to a 501c3, it's also tax deductible to the people who make it. The governor has raised a lot of money for the Protocol Foundation. Protocol Foundation is a nonprofit group that pays for a lot of the governor's travel.
Whether it's overseas or around the country or whatever.
Right, and also I believe puts him up at the Hyatt Hotel in Sacramento, pays the bill for that.
And I think also pays for his jet back and forth to Southern California. But I think the point is I mean, these kinds of entities have become very commonplace, and as you were just laying out, and I think you're exactly right. I mean, they are not money for a campaign, but it's impossible to argue they are not money given to have a connection with a lawmaker.
Absolutely, and you know, these are donations that are solicited often by these politicians, and you know, people don't give this money just out of the goodness of their heart. Perhaps that's an overly cynical outlook on it, but I think that it has the effect, even though the money can't be used in the same way, it has a lot of similar effects as a campaign contribution does, in that it often will get you access to that politician.
You know, I was going to just make an observation about the Fair Political Practices Commission. The chairman of that commission now, Ross Johnson, a long time, well-known Republican legislator. If anybody knew campaign money as a politician and now watches it as a watchdog, that would be Ross Johnson. It's a very interesting, you know, progression of his career and his time around state government, it seems like to me. And Ross Johnson, who spent a lot of time looking at campaign money as a legislator, but also who was one of the guys who crafted the ballot measure that a lot of people say opened the floodgates more for campaign committees, which is different than what you're talking about, but nonetheless now has become a very aggressive chairman of the FPPC in watching money.
Absolutely, and I think that that his whole mantra, even when he was in the state Senate working on what became Proposition 34, which is what you were referencing earlier.
Indeed.
The ballot measure, which ended up being approved by voters and then set campaign contribution limits, but
set them higher than they were under a different measure, and some
right.
people said cynically was an attempt to change the game and not let the voters know what was happening. Sorry.
And move a lot of the power to the parties.
Yes,
to the
right.
political parties.
Unlimited contributions to parties, right.
Right, but I think that Ross Johnson has always just been a proponent of disclosure. You know, it's very difficult with campaign finance to close all the loopholes. I think those who have tried would be the first to tell you that money finds its way in one way or another. And there is a school of thought out there that says, "Hey, look, let's open up the floodgates, let all the money come in that wants to come in, but just make sure that people know and make sure that there's." Fair, accurate, and immediate disclosure of this money.
That's the discussion you get, right, exactly. 24-hour disclosure of everything, of every dollar, because, you know, now there is a threshold. There's a $5,000 threshold.
Right, even on
a lot of these 24-hour notifications to the public that we were referencing before. Right, some people just say everything. You got to report everything instantaneously if we open the floodgates.
And on these behested payments as well, the $41.3 million that is referenced in the Capital Weekly story, since January 2008, only reflects those payments of $5,000 or more, because there is that threshold there. And if you give less than $5,000, you don't have to declare the behested payment at all.
Hmm.
So the actual number may be much, much higher.
All right, so topic three is also money, but it's a different kind of money. And just a quick mention of the way the federal stimulus money is making its way through California government. Since you got to plug a Capital Weekly story before, I'm getting to plug myself now, so be prepared.
That's why we podcast.
That's right. It's a plug podcast. Plug away, I think. Wasn't that a sketch on Saturday Night Live? Plug away. Anyway.
Plug away. That was an Al Checky hair commercial? No.
No, but it had... That's really a different podcast, Anthony. You're going to get in trouble there. No, it was simply a joke sketch about that people just came on to plug their movies, plug whatever. Anyway, so the story that I did this week for the California Report was just trying to get some sense of the way stimulus money is being watched, who controls it, how the process goes. It is a tremendously complicated process. I mean, the federal legislation did not make it clear not only about how to apply for the money and how to get it, but also who controls it. The governor has a lead role in making applications for money in California. The legislature appropriates money, so the two have to work together. But what I really found most interesting was the oversight. Five different entities have now been set up somehow to oversee this money. They are the two committees in the legislature. They are two committees that have been given those marching orders by their bosses, by the speaker and the pro tem. There is the governor appointing an inspector general last week, Laura Chick, the termed-out controller of Los Angeles, the city. There's the GAO, the Government Accounting Office out of Washington, which is actually bringing more people into California. I talked to their Western director, who said they're going to basically have people in Sacramento and in local communities a lot over the next 2 years watching the money. And the state auditor, Elaine Howe, who already does a lot of watching of how federal dollars are spent in California. That's a tremendous number of people ostensibly doing almost the same job, which begs the question, how's that going to work? What's the overlap, doubling of duties? You know, everybody wants to prevent waste, fraud, and abuse, but, I mean, five different entities seems like a lot.
Yeah, and this that doesn't even take into account the policy committees. I mean, I think, you know, we've both been at some of these hearings where or some of the policy committees have been looking at the stimulus money in various areas to see how it goes. And you know, there, the federal government has, you know, we've seen the vice president be very outspoken about putting states on notice that money must be spent wisely, otherwise they
were famously saying no swimming pools.
No swimming pools. But you know, you talk to people on the ground here, and there are very few rules beyond that. Other than no swimming pools, there are not a whole lot of specific guidelines on how states or counties or, in some cases, private companies should spend this money. So there is a lot of confusion, as you said, on both ends of the process, and I think trying to monitor how the money is coming in and how it's being spent is going to be a full-time job, not only for a lot of people in government, but a lot of people like us in the press corps who are trying to stick with the old Watergate edict and
follow the money. Yeah. Well, and you know, one, I was going to make a quick mention of something that you and I've talked about here on the podcast before, which is this notion of small programs all of a sudden getting a tremendous amount of money.
Right.
When I was talking to the state auditor, Elaine Howe, she made a very good point about this that I thought is worth repeating. Last year, she said her office audited 43 federal programs in California, you know, that spend federal money in California. Of those 43, 20 of them had not been audited in 3 years because they were so small. And as a result, because they're so small, you know, you don't typically spend a lot of resources on auditing them. You audit them every so often. But as she said to me, she said, that's a high-risk area when you start to put a lot of money into those small programs, because you've got people who really aren't familiar with having that much money and that much responsibility.
Right, right. And, you know, that was one of the first things that jumped out at me. Two or three weeks ago, we discussed this on the podcast.
Yeah.
You know, in the energy sector, there was a $2 million program that got $250 million in federal funds. And, you know, and how do you, bureaucratically and systematically, how do you go through administering that money? I mean, you're talking about a huge growth, not just in the program, but in the administration and in the bureaucracy. And I think that is, you know, some of the danger. Look, there are a handful of very smart people in state government, smart bureaucrats who understand how to pull the levers of government, who are going to end up exerting tremendous influence over large pots of this money.
And with that, I think I'm going to let you go back to your spring break.
Woohoo!
You have a good time. I will hold down the fort here in Sacramento.
You're such a martyr.
I am such a martyr.
John Martyrs.
I'm doing the people's work, Anthony.
Is that what it is?
I'm trying to do the people's
good.
Work.
Well,
all right. Well,
never mind.
for our friend, the editor of Capital Weekly, Anthony York, at his undisclosed Southern California location. Anthony, have a good time.
Okay, thank you, sir.
All right.
You too. Happy Passover, Easter, and whatnot.
Happy whatever you're celebrating. I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.